Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the woodsman Ray Mears, a traveller to the world's remotest corners and a renowned expert in bushcraft, wild cooking and survival techniques. He's one of my very few guests, I imagine, who would genuinely relish the challenges of a desert island. Those of us not possessed of his spirit and skill can live vicariously through his exploits on TV and through his survival handbooks. Enlightening and entertaining the sofa-bound masses is, however, only one strand on his hand-whittled bow. Among many other things, he's trained elite troops in the British Army, and in 2010, he was called upon by police to help them track the fugitive killer Raoul Moat. It was survival skills of a different type he needed when he lost his first wife, Rachel, to cancer. He met his second wife, Ruth, at a book signing, and the attraction was apparently instant. They share not just a love of each other, but also, luckily, of the great outdoors. He says of the wild, "I can see nature, I feel it intuitively, and I can understand what can't be written." Let's try to talk then for just a moment, Ray Mears, about what can't be written. When you are out there immersed in nature, what is it you feel?
It's hard to explain. You feel totally alive. If you take the time to understand how things fit together, the uses and the meanings of the things around you, it's like you plug into nature in a very deep and profound way.
And how do you think that affects you as a person?
I think it's very good for you. I think we have a lot of latent abilities that our evolution has provided us. Hand-eye coordination, sensory awareness, perception. There are so many qualities that we have. They're part of our makeup. And there's a frustration that comes from not being able to use them. And in teaching others about the outdoors, all I have to do is unlock the gateway to those latent abilities, and they come flooding forwards, and the joy of using them is then revealed.
I wasn't sure how to introduce you. In the end, I plumped for the word woodsman because it is the word you yourself use. Why is it that you choose that word?
Oh, because I like forests. I love trees. I can't be very far from trees. And forests are they're quite difficult places. I mean, that may seem surprising. Yes, you've got lots of resources that you can tap into, but they're very secretive places. As habitats, they are full of nooks and crannies, and it takes a long while to develop the skills to actually find what's living there.
You are an incredibly practical person, of course you are, and yet it strikes me in everything that I see and read that there's definitely a spiritual element there. I mean, one of the things that always strikes me about a forest is the light in a forest. Something happens in a forest that makes it different from other places.
It's true. I mean, it changes second by second. I mean, I think if you go into a church and you see architecture that mimics a forest, it's a poor second. But also you have the sounds of a forest and how the leaves of the trees can tell you the changing season, because the leaves dry, they make a different sound. I mean, one of the most amazing things that we ever tried to do televisually was in the forests of the very far north of Australia. We went up to a high point way before first light to try and record the sound of the dawn coming, because the dawn is heralded by birdsong. You can hear that the sun is coming before you can see it. And in a place there, the landscape of that scale, you can hear that wave of bird voices coming before the light reaches you. It's a very special thing.
Tell me now then, Ray Mears, about your first piece of music. What are we going to hear and why have you chosen it?
I need some music that I could work to while I'm building my island. And I envisage putting up a flagpole. I want to put up a British flag on this island. So I wanted a very British anthem that reminded me of my youth, that also might act as a kind of a repellent for any of those nasty cruise ships that might try and turn up and bring tourists with them. And so this is Jumpin' Jack Flash from the Rolling Stones. What's it?
The Rolling Stones and Jumpin' Jack Flash. I mentioned Ray Mears in the introduction then, that you're one of very few castaways who actually could stay alive on a desert island. If I was marooned, I shouldn't have more than 4 coconuts a day, is that right?
Coconut is the tree of life. If you have too many green coconuts, they make you go to the toilet. But it's got so many uses. You know, the husk you can make into fibre, make rope from that. You can make hats and baskets and bedding. It's a really important thing.
Along with coconuts, what I would also need on this desert island is a knife. And with that, quickly, you would make what?
It's always good to have a fire. Because if you're going to make fire by friction, you need to do it while you've still got energy. I mean, if you haven't got a knife, I mean, you can make a knife out of a seashell.
I like the way you're thinking. But what you also really need, you're displaying to me here, is very precise knowledge of your environment.
You have to know what you're doing.
Yes.
Yes.
I mentioned in the introduction that you helped the police track down Raoul Moat. He was the man who, on his release from prison, went to his ex-girlfriend's house. He shot her. He killed her boyfriend. He then went on to shoot a policeman before going on the run. What was it that you were using that other people and indeed the police officers themselves might have missed? What did you bring to them?
40 years of tracking animals and tracking... I track people as well. I track anything that moves. I'm looking for tiny disturbances. The things that are very, very small disturbances in nature are significant to me. I'm not following footprints. Anyone can do that. So bruises to leaves, tiny dead twigs that may be broken, and with experience you can look and know how long they've been broken.
It seems incredibly low-tech, that sort of skill.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yes.
I like low-tech. GPS is great, but I still like the compass. The great thing about low-tech is it's completely reliable. You know, there's not much to go wrong with it.
So when you go out yourself into the wild, what are you taking now that you wouldn't have taken 50 years ago?
If I'm guiding a party of people and I didn't have with me a satellite phone and a GPS, and there was a problem, somebody might point the finger and say, well, you should have had it with you.
Right.
Personally, I don't feel a need to take any of those things at all. But don't get me wrong, I've been doing this all my life, so I know how to take care of myself. If a young, less experienced, you know, adventurer is going off into wild places, there are devices they can take with them that will signal their location. Fantastic.
But given the choice, you wouldn't?
Sometimes my wife will say, well, I want you to take a sat phone so that I know that I can contact you, which is, that's cool. But I don't feel the need in myself to take those things. In fact, I like to not have them.
Because it gives you a sense of what? Of freedom?
It's wonderful. Oh, come on. To de-assimilate from the cyber hive, it's wonderful. It's great to just, you know, switch off from all of that.
De-assimilate from the cyber hive. That is my phrase of the week. For now, that we're going to have some more music. Tell me about our second disc of the morning. What are we going to hear?
I was thinking about, you know, surviving on a desert island. And there's one factor that very often is forgotten by all the experts, and that is what brings people back. And there were two people that come to mind. One was a man called Scott O'Grady, who survived 196 days in the Australian outback after his plane crashed. He survived because he wanted a girlfriend. He'd never had a girlfriend, and he wanted a car. And then there was another man who'd survived captivity and escaping from the Burma Railroad. And what kept him going was the desire to see his wife and his daughter again. And I think that's a really important thing, the sense of wanting to get back to see a loved one. Even a future loved one. So I've chosen this song, which is by The Jam. I think it really says that. Of course, it's English Rose.
No matter where I roam, I will return to my English Rose. For no bonds can ever tempt me from she. I sailed the seven seas, flown the whole blue sky, but I've returned with haste to where my love does lie. No matter where I go.
That was The Jam and English Rose. So, Ray Mears, tell me about your parents, Leslie and Dorothy. Were they well travelled?
They were very well travelled. In the 50s, they were travelling around, they were jet setting around the world. My father was a very talented printer. He was involved in security printing.
That's things like banknotes and so on. Yeah.
I was very lucky. I had wonderful parents. My mum's amazing. My father's no longer with us, but he was an incredible human being.
And you were brought up then, after this sort of exotic amount of travel, they came back and settled in Purley, was it?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
And that's where you were brought up. Did you have, I hope you did, a sort of swallows and Amazons childhood?
It was that wonderful era before mobile phones. You know, you used to cycle everywhere, play in the woods. I mean, I think of it as a childhood in sunshine, really.
Little 7-8-year-old Ray Mears, then, when he was out and about and when he was given the whole day to himself, as he frequently was, what would I have found him doing?
All sorts of things. Poking around, looking at nature. One of the most exciting things for me was finding my first edible plant. I found a book in the library that had photographs and descriptions of what things you could eat. And with great trepidation, I went out in search of one of these plants. And I found this little plant that grows in the woods called wood sorrel. It has a clover-like leaf. And I tasted it. It tastes of apple peel. And, of course, from that moment forward, I was hooked on wild foods. They don't all taste as good as that. But
And your parents gave you, I understand, a map when you were a young teenager. What did you do with it?
I must have been probably 14, I suppose, maybe younger. And they bought me my first Ordnance Survey map, amazing, and a compass. And I decided I was going to go and fill my water bottle from a spring. And I found the spring, I think it was 12 miles away. And off I went to find it. And that was my first lessons in navigation. And of course, it's something, you know, you need to develop great expertise in if you're going to travel in wild places. The compass is the key to the wilderness. But I got that sense that day of filling that water bottle from that spring, which was buried deep in a bank of stinging nettles, was a very profound moment in my life.
When was your very first expedition?
I remember one trip on the North Downs Way, and I didn't have a sleeping bag and I didn't have a tent. But, you know, I don't remember any hardship. You light the fire and you sit around the fire, and life is one big adventure because you're feeling independent and free. And that's a really important thing. And I often meet young people today who, because of health and safety regulations, are encumbered with huge rucksacks with far too much in them of, you know, tornado-proof equipment that weighs much more. I wouldn't dream of carrying some of that gear. And I remember back to when I started, I didn't have anything. Knowledge was more important than equipment, and that was a good place to start.
Let's have some more music, Ray. We're on your third. Tell me about this.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important when you're on an island is imagination. And one of the things that concerns me about a desert island is it can be a little bit confining. So the ability to drift off in your imagination and go to new places is really important. And I think this song really sums that up. And this is one of my favourite groups, The Beatles. And it is, of course, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green, towering over your head.
That was The Beatles and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. So tell me then, Ray Mears, about your education. You went to a nice little prep school, and I imagine there wasn't much sort of throwing you out and giving you a bit of bushcraft there. It was sort of sitting down and learning your times tables, was it?
Yeah, and Latin, which I hated. But we were lucky that one of the things that we did at the school was judo. That was a compulsory lesson. It was not sport. It was a life skill. You know, people who do judo will understand that if you lose your temper on the judo mat, someone will throw you. So it's about self-control and self-discipline, as well as the gentle way, using wisdom rather than strength.
Kingsley Hopkins is somebody that you've talked about often. Was he a judo teacher?
He was a judo instructor at the school, right. And he was a very special man. He had fought in the Second World War in Burma and introduced me to bushcraft, really. But it was much more than that. One of the things he encouraged me to do was to question the source of knowledge. So if there's an accepted wisdom, try to get to understand where it came from. Take it apart so you can put it back together and understand how it works, rather like taking an old-fashioned engine apart. If you put it back together, you know what the bits do, and you can test whether it's true or not.
And what about your interest in animals? You were interested in foxes and what else?
Anything. Foxes particularly. But I like to track them and follow them and get to know them and understand them. And I got to a point where if there was a fox watching me, I'd turn around and look it straight in the eye. And I felt that I developed a special rapport with them.
Do you take the view then that when people are in situations with animals, when they come into danger, you know, when they are savaged by an animal, when an animal goes for them, that is to do with the fact that they are not tuning in to the dialogue, if you like, that can take place between
us. Yes, but it depends so much on the circumstances.
Right.
You might come into conflict with an animal because that animal has already decided that it is going to harm you, to warn you off. You may be too close to a food source of an animal, not even be aware of it. Or it can be a situation where there is no potential harm going to occur if you pay attention to what's going on, but you're so blinded by your fear that you do the wrong thing. First thing you have to have is the knowledge of how the animal you're dealing with is likely to behave. In most cases, when you're close to an animal, if you've done your homework, there are signs and indications that that animal is giving you that you can read and interpret that will enable you to pass peacefully with this creature.
You once luckily passed peacefully with a very, very large saltwater crocodile. Mm. It was how big?
4 or 5 metres long, something like that. It was the size of a canoe, so...
Tell me what happened.
I was camping in northern Australia. We were filming, had a lot of snorers in the camp, so I'd moved my mosquito net further away. I like to be on my own in the bush. And that day I'd speared a stingray and we cooked it on the beach. And what I didn't know at that time is that crocodiles have a particular penchant for both sharks and for stingrays. That night, I'm in my mosquito net and I'm woken up by the sound of this enormous crocodile just beside me. And I thought at the time, I knew they were dangerous. And I thought, well, I'll keep my hand on my machete and if it does anything, I'll bash it on the nose. What I didn't realise, and I didn't realise until this year when I made a more in-depth documentary, is just how dangerous they are. And if that crocodile had made an attempt at grabbing me, he would have done so and I wouldn't be talking to you now. They are incredibly powerful creatures.
Let's have some music, Ray. What are we going to hear? It's your fourth of the morning. Tell me about this.
This is Annie's Song by John Denver. Whenever I hear this song, it reminds me of why I like... For me, Annie is nature. And the song captures for me the feeling I have for being in wild places.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again.
That was John Denver's Annie's Song. Ray Mears, it's interesting to me that you ended up following this varied and fascinating path in life that you have because you didn't join the Marines. What happened?
My eyesight wasn't good enough. I'm short-sighted. It's never stopped me tracking, but anyway. And I guess it was meant to be because I wouldn't have done all the things that I've done since.
And here's a very peculiar thing. When you didn't get into the Marines, you decided to go and work in the city.
I know, I didn't know what to do. I just drifted off into the world, really. And I hated it.
Right.
I mean, I worked in those days, people smoked in offices.
Yes.
And there were three of us that didn't smoke in an office of 20 people.
And so you then went to work on Operation Raleigh, and this is, for people who don't know, it gives young people this opportunity to go out and experience the world and work on lots of different projects in often far away and inhospitable places. Was there a moment where things sort of fell into place where you thought, yes, I think this is the world
I
belong in?
I mean, for me, that was a very special thing. When I joined Operation Raleigh, it was the proper expedition that kicked off Raleigh International as we know it today. And this remarkable group of largely ex-military adventurers who had come together to put this expedition together, working out of the old War Office building. And in there, I met other young guys who had an interest in the outdoors. And we cross-trained each other in different disciplines. You know, it was a wonderful experience.
And for you, it seems to me that learning, always learning is the thing, is that when you realise that you are interested in something, almost the first thing you want to do is become an expert in it, to amass knowledge, to find the person who you need to learn from. Is that fair?
I don't want to become an expert in it. I don't like the term expert. I like to be a student. I'm a student of life. And when I'm interested in a subject, I want to take it apart. And I want to find the very, very best person to teach me. And I will listen very carefully to what they've got to say and try to understand where they're coming from. And I have found in my life that that has borne fruit.
And when you decided that you were going to set up courses to pass on your knowledge and the things that you'd learned and to enable people to be out in the wild environment and make the best of it, it was because you realised that you actually had a bit more knowledge than the people who were teaching these courses.
What had happened was while I'd worked at UpRally, we'd worked in some various outdoor centres and I'd come across people teaching these sorts of skills, but they didn't really have that knowledge. And I was going and collecting mushrooms to cook for breakfast, and people who were supposedly teaching this stuff couldn't recognise what they were. And I thought, well, if this person's making a living doing this, maybe I could.
One of the first courses that you led, I think, was teaching 20 soldiers in Wales what to do if they were out in the environment. How did you get on? What was your biggest challenge there?
Well, to stop them drifting off to the pub, put them on the far side of a river in Spate. But actually, the kind of people they were, they wouldn't have done that anyway. So they were pretty good. It was very wet. Sometimes when the weather's at its worst, that's when I like it most. I think the more skilled you become in a subject, the more it is the case that when it's easy, it's a bit dull. Yeah, on my desert island, I think the storms will be the best times.
Do you feel very different from most people?
No, not at all. It's unpleasant if there's a storm and you're having to deal with it. But then there's the satisfaction of having dealt with it. And then there's the joy of being able to dry everything when it's gone, you know. So why sit around and be miserable? You just get on with it.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about this. We're on your fifth.
Well, I mean, I thought if there was, you know, a passing ship, they might, by perusing my island through their binoculars, decide that there's no reason to come and stay because it would be in such good order. They'd see the flag flying there and a nicely ordered shelter and the beginnings of a boat being constructed. So I thought, well, what better than to have some sort of party anthem to draw them to shore? And what I've gone for is this song by Blondie, which to me is one of the most amazing rock anthems. It's Maria.
That was Maria and Blondie. I hope you don't think this is an unfair question, Ray Mears, but I'm wondering if your obsessiveness makes you quite a hard person to live with.
Obsessive? I don't know. You'd have to ask my wife. She'd probably agree with you. I don't think I'm obsessive, though. I'm actually quite relaxed, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, most people, if they don't understand something, they'll go some way to try and understand it, but there's a point at which they leave it behind. It seems to me that until you really drill down and get to the bottom of something, you will not leave it behind if you're interested in it.
Yeah, but that's fun. I mean, I think obsessive suggests something that's negative in some way. I don't feel that
right.
At all. I mean, I become absorbed in a subject, but that's the fun of it, it's the joy of it.
As I mentioned, you've been married twice. Your first wife, Rachel, died of cancer. And I'm wondering, given that you are somebody who is used to coping and used to being entirely capable, how did that affect you at the time?
I'm sure anyone who's been through it and who's going through it knows it's an incredibly difficult thing to deal with. For me, it's something I couldn't fix, and I found that very difficult.
Yes.
It's just one of those things. It's one of those things that we have to deal with, and you hope you never experience it.
In terms of moving forward, I've read you say that you decided that was then, and you had to make a now. That was your plan, was it? That was your sort of your way.
It was a chapter that was a chapter in my life, and a very important chapter. And you have to make a fresh start. I think that's really important. Otherwise, you just drift on, and I don't think that's right. I don't think that's appropriate. For me, I don't think that was appropriate.
What helped you get through it?
I went to the gym every night. The evenings are the worst time, and that's when you feel alone, I guess. And doing something positive, something physical, was really helpful.
Tell me about meeting Ruth.
Well, I was very lucky. I was delivering a lecture in Newcastle, and this apparition appeared from the crowds, ran up to talk to me at the end of the show and literally knocked me off my feet. Just the force of energy that she brought with her was quite something.
What, you fell over?
I literally fell over.
Did you?
Head over heels.
And it was that, really? It was a thunderbolt?
It was a thunderbolt, yeah.
And lucky for you, she was described by her friends as a bit outdoorsy.
Yeah, yes. She is. She's very adventurous. She's got a lot of spirit.
Let's go to the music. We've got your sixth piece of music this morning. Ray, tell me about this.
Well, this reminds me of seeing Ruth. And it's a fantastic piece of music. It's very important to both of us. It's Suddenly I See by Katie Tunstall.
Her face is a map of the world, is a map of the world. You can see she's a beautiful girl, she's a beautiful girl. And everything around her is a silver pool.
That was Katie Tunstall and Suddenly I See. Tell me, Ray Mears, do you happily fly in helicopters these days?
Yeah.
I ask you because, well, you'll know why I ask you. In Wyoming, in I think it was 2005, it was a pretty horrific-looking accident you had in a helicopter. What do you remember of it?
Looking out the window, thinking we're very low. Looking out again, thinking we're going to hit the ground. And as I thought that, the alarms went off inside the helicopter and I took a brace position. And we impacted on my side. And one of the witnesses of the crash then tells me that basically we bounced up, lost power. That I remember. I remember that helicopter seemed like it was clawing the air. It came down on the tail rotor. The tail rotor snapped off, flew over the top. And the helicopter upended. We somersaulted, impacting three times before it skidded to a halt. And I remember the sound of the aluminium grinding as we did so, and then the fuel which had come out of the back of the helicopter landed as a cloud on top of us.
Remarkably, there were no fatalities, but there were some very serious injuries.
Yeah, there were, yeah.
What were you doing?
I was providing first aid. It was the cameraman beside me. He broke his back and both of his legs in the crash, and the pilot also fractured his spine. So yeah, it was pretty serious.
It is also the case that just a day after that crash, word reached you that your father had died. I mean, it's unimaginable to me that you could take on board that amount of trauma in one very short period. How on earth did you deal with it all?
I don't know. You just do. You have no choice. It was very, very difficult. It was a lot all at once, yeah.
See, you're such a coper. I mean, everything I've read about you, everything I see, that here's this incredibly sort of solid man with his feet planted on the ground. Do you ever feel that things become too much?
Yeah, no, they can be. Yeah, definitely. I guess things like this in some ways are easier to deal with.
This is the crash.
My job, yes. I have a professional side of me, is teaching people to cope.
Yes.
So you have to do what you teach. The hardest things to deal with is overwork. I mean, that's a that creeps up on you. You can't perceive it. And that's a much more difficult thing to deal with.
Let's have some music, Ray Mears. It's your seventh. Tell me about this.
Well, I think it's very easy to lose sight of nature when you live in an urban setting. And there's one particular song that always reminds me of that. And that's Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters by Elton John.
While Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters, sons of bankers, sons of lawyers, turn around and say good morning to the night. For unless they see the sky, but they can't, and that is why. They know not if it's dark outside or light.
Elton John with Mona Lisa's and Mad Hatters. So, Ray Mears, I noticed that somebody asked you in an interview about fox hunting, and you said very interestingly, I thought, that while all the kerfuffle was going on about fox hunting, some songbirds are heading for the red list, and that was something that got your tail up more than anything to do with
foxes. I get
really
annoyed with the political debates over all these things. Foxes, you know I like them, but it's not an endangered species. There are other far more important things that we should be keeping an eye on. To me, it's the measure of how good a government is whether they can, in one sense, solve the economic crises and problems of the world, but also have enough magnanimity about themselves to deal with the other issues. And we live at a time now where there's a huge pressure to build on the Greenbelt. Now, as I understood it, that was put aside in perpetuity by our ancestors, our elders. And I think it should still be so.
Well, there are lots of people who want a nice house to live in, or just any house to live in.
Of course, I don't disagree with that. But at the same time, if we don't have green spaces, what sort of people do we become living in those houses?
Now, I feel we should in some way take advantage of your knowledge before I cast you away. If any of us ever are to find ourselves, unfortunately, on a desert island when we don't want to be there, what are the first things we should do?
You obviously have to make sure you can preserve life, so you have to consider what might be the threats to you. So first of all, you should stop and think about your situation. Look around and make a plan. So that's what we always say.
How does one find a source of fresh water on an island?
Depends on the island and where you are in the world. It's so complex, Kirsty. In some places you might find on the coast water seeping from the rocks. In other places you might have to look into hollows in volcanic rock where water can be trapped, where there's shade. You might look for casuarina trees and dig at their base because they need fresh water. But you must take care of the fundamentals and also to consider whether anyone might come looking for you. There's a good chance that you should build some signals ready in case somebody comes.
Right, we're going to go to your eighth disc of the morning then, your final one. Tell me about this, Ray.
This song means a lot to me. This is my evening music, my night music. I'm going to wait for one of those times when the wind stops and the sea goes absolutely calm and the palm fronds stop moving. And then I'm going to turn the volume right up and play this amazing song, which is called Feeling Good by Nina Simone.
Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Nina Simone, Feeling Good. So, Ray, it's time for the books now. I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you're allowed to take another book along to this island. What will your book be?
Oh, it's very difficult. Gosh, I love books. Could I take an empty book so that I can make notes of what I learn while I'm there?
Yes, of course you can.
Because I think that would be really interesting.
And a luxury too. Now, I'm hoping you're going to choose something really pointless, like a pair of sort of feathered
high heels.
You won't
let me take a machete, will you?
You know, people in the past have been allowed to take knives. It's a moot point.
Do you know, I think I can manage without. So what about a really big pair of speakers so I can pump up the volume?
You can certainly do that. Yes, a really big pair of speakers is yours then. And if you had to save just one of these eight tracks, which one would you save?
I think it would be Maria by Blondie.
It's yours. Ray Mears, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.